Hello, everybody, and welcome to the PC Gamer Show. My name is James Davenport, and I'm here today with Evan Lotti, our editor-in-chief. How are you
doing? What's up, James?
Oh, not much. I'm back, sort of, mostly. My voice is still recovering, but I'm here.
You got to have one of those, do one of these, James.
What's that?
You got to have a voice to do a podcast.
It's true. Yeah, it's true. I tried to do one last week. If you guys weren't there, it was like basically like a bootleg VHS discount bin version of the PC Gamer Show where I played XCOM and in my own apartment. But nice. Anyway, we're also here with Bo Moore, our technology
Hey, that's me.
Editor. How you doing, Bo?
I'm doing well. Thank you
Great.
For having me. We're glad to see you back among the living.
Yes.
Not, in fact, dead.
Half living. But anyway, we got a good show today going on.
So much to talk about.
There's a lot to talk about. Oh, I had a hard time with collating my news notes and what I've been playing, and there's a lot going on. But a brief rundown. We're going to talk about news. We all brought something to talk about there. We're going to talk about, of course, the sort of the controversy and the conflict between Camposanto and PewDiePie and his big mess up and what legal recourse Camposanto has. Tyler did a great write-up. We'll get to that. And we're going to talk about XCOM 2 War of the Chosen because we have all
been playing it like quite a bit.
It's rare that a game kind of courses through the PC Gamer office as hard as XCOM is right now, but it's grabbed a lot of us and we're really, really digging it.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about that, what we've been playing, of course, and we'll do our usual Twitch chat Q&A to wrap it up. But to get started, I want to talk about, Evan, how many weeks has it been since PAX West?
It was last week.
Last week.
So it feels like it was like a month ago.
Well, I guess it was like the previous weekend before last.
Okay.
Right. And it was the last weekend of last month, but it ended on Monday.
Gotcha. So you saw a lot of good stuff there. You and Steven had some great videos coming out of there, and you wanted to highlight a few of the games.
Sure. I could go through, a dozen things that we saw that were interesting. I think off the bat, though, if you like Clay Entertainment, if you like what they've done with Don't Starve and Oxygen Not Included and their other titles, Invisible Ink, really talented independent studio out of Vancouver with some great animation talent, I guess.
Yeah.
So Grifflands is their latest game, not out yet, but it was playable for the first time at PAX. Sort of as a surprise, they were very quiet about this. It was just sort of sitting there on the floor with a bunch of stations, and I'm like, all right, you guys didn't let us know. You didn't send out a press release. I guess I'll sit down and play this thing. And, man, really promising. I think I was really struck by the sound design, I remember. But, okay, I mean, the basic way of putting this game is, like, it is Clay's take on a JRPG or, like, a Final Fantasy-style game.
Oh, right? Interesting.
So it's got this kind of turn-based battle system, but I don't think it has movement as part of that battle system. But it has this sort of more Western emphasis on choice and morality and sort of open-ended sandbox aspect of it. So I won't go too deeply into it because I know there's so much else we want to talk about,
sure.
But really promising first impression. They've got some interesting work being done to like design this like alien language that all the characters speak.
Really? They're doing that. They're going all in on the language.
Yeah, but there's the level of detail is amazing for a game made by a small studio, right? So like I crafted a sword, for example, and as soon as it was crafted, my character, it was like replaced, the 2D art was replaced on their back.
Wow.
It was
wow.
with like a unique weapon generated by this crafting system. So and they must have drawn hundreds of swords, basically.
That's crazy. That's cool.
Anyway, so really promising, really encouraging. We're going to do some more stuff on that. Another game I want to mention is called Deep Rock Galactic. So this is very different. It's a four-player co-op shooter.
One way to put it.
I would say it's Left 4 Dead with space dwarves in procedurally generated alien caves.
All right.
That's how I would put it. So each dwarf has like a special kind of role or ability. Right now we're seeing the digger, I think they're called, that has like these massive drills they can punch through walls and surfaces. But you're wandering around in the dark, you've got flares you're throwing out, you've got these zip lines that help you get across these chasms, and you're sitting in these caves to get like a specific kind of ore out of the ground, bring it back to your company. Well, actually, you're going from sort of like point A, your spawn point, to point B at the end of the level. So just like Left 4 Dead, that's sort of a get to the chopper moment, right? Where you've got the stuff and you have to get there and you're being chased by all these kind of spider-like enemies. There's different tiers of them. There's really big ones, there's small ones, they crawl on the ceiling. Really promising, fun game. I was worried it wouldn't be enough of a shooter, but it's sort of a nice mixture of like physical problem solving and being in the dark with your friends and shooting these enemies.
It looks really nice. Got a nice look to it. I'm excited for that. I love asymmetrical, kind of weird co-op games like that. So
me too.
Very, very excited.
All right. Third game in this rapid fire packs, you know, 4 days in 4 minutes or whatever this is. Phantom Brigade, which is not Phantom Doctrine. We'll talk about that. Two different games with Phantom. This is a turn-based mech game in the style of XCOM. So if you liked Front Mission, you know, that old Square Enix turn-based tactics game, I think this is definitely your cup of tea. If you like Armored Core, but also XCOM, this is definitely, you know, something you want to take a look at. Maybe you could scrub forward in this video a little bit. It's a really long gameplay video. So
get to some combat.
I think what's most impressive is, for one thing, I love the UI design. I don't know if this is like the final thing that we're seeing. This is like an older video. They don't have a lot of recent video based on what I saw. But, you know, destructibility, nemesis system, okay, between like the enemies you encounter. The pilots kind of gain traits and stuff like that based on events that happen in the mission. So there's, again, this idea of sort of XCOM influenced. I guess we're going to be talking about War of the Chosen, how your characters get affected over time. That kind of stuff. Everything in the world can be destructed. Open sandbox campaign where you might like have to rescue pilots and stuff like that. And in the spirit of games like BattleTech and MechWarrior, you're destroying enemy mechs and sort of bringing back to your base, doing a full outfitting and customization and stuff like that. They talked to me about how they have like all the full mech tropes of, you know, shields and grenade launchers and like cluster missiles and all that kind of thing. But yeah, the guy making this worked on Kerbal Space Program modding. So it's also going to be fully moddable. So that's super encouraging. I mean, not something I expect from an independent developer to sort of make this kind of game and then open it up to other folks to add their own stuff. So
cool. It looks really nice.
Definitely on my radar. But it's, again, this is Phantom Brigade, not Phantom Doctrine, which is another XCOM style turn-based strategy game. But it's set in the Cold War, and you can capture agents and torture them and brainwash them. So those are different games.
Different game.
Of course.
Both called Phantom something.
I think maybe if you're developing a game, just a hot tip, avoid the Phantom in the title for now.
For now.
Just for now.
Yeah.
We'll get back around to it in a couple of years. But yeah.
cool. Yeah. Yeah, I think the only other thing I'd add from PAX, I didn't take any so-called AAA appointments.
Sure.
Partly because Gamescom was so recently and all the demos and stuff were kind of recycled, right? I mean, Far Cry was there and all that kind of thing. But, man, PC gaming is such a saturated market. I say that with happiness and a little bit of concern for some of these developers who are doing incredible stuff, but many of them are going to struggle, you know, to get the attention they deserve, to find their audience. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think, a natural part of making games these days, because there's so many people doing it and the tools are so accessible and so cheap and so easy to get into. There's a lot of talent, a lot of choice out there. And sort of at the other end of the spectrum, we have these so-called skyscraper games, right? Like Overwatch, Dota 2, CSGO, Battlegrounds is going to become one of them, right? Which it's in your interest as a player, if you like that game, to invest all or almost all of your time in them, because the games require sort of maintenance and sort of maintaining your skill, right? And they're continually updating. You know, Overwatch is getting a new update every 6 weeks or something
that's like
fairly significant. So, man, tons of competition. I mean, as a PC gamer, you've got to love the spectrum of different stuff that's happening on the platform, but you got to wonder kind of what's gonna give, because it's a really competitive landscape out there if you're making games.
Yeah, exciting and overwhelming. During our meetings, there's so many games we just bring up that half of us have never heard of, and 5 to 6 years ago we would have just covered, I would imagine, you know, easily. But
yeah,
at least hopefully we can champion some good games and bring them out for you guys. I want to just call out a game. Have you guys heard of Tooth and Tail?
Yeah,
I've heard of it. I haven't. I know very little about it.
Right. It's from the developer Pocket Watch. The developers, they made a game called Monaco, a kind of a cooperative heist game, and it was free last weekend, I think. Nice. So in case you missed out, hopefully you grabbed it because it's a great, great time.
Yeah, I'm going to paraphrase a good quote that Andy Schatz, the one of the lead developers on the game, mm-hmm. had, which is he wants to do for StarCraft what Hearthstone did for card games.
Yes.
If that makes sense. So it's you're controlling a single character in this real-time strategy game, and what you're like rallying different types of creatures toward you.
Yeah.
It's like very simple base building and very like short matches often, but like, yeah, less emphasis on like intricate micro, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Controlling one character is, and kind of the maps being relatively small, mm-hmm. makes, you know, that I think a lot of real-time strategy games might turn people off because it's a huge map. You're controlling mm-hmm. all these, you know, platoons and units that have their own, you know, relationships with other units and other, you know, factions entirely. And that's all here, but it's definitely kind of simplified. I haven't played a bunch, but I played it a couple months ago with Tom. We hopped into this, and it's a really simple and you know, interface. You move it like you would any third-person character. There's no, you know, clicking around a map. It's got an amazing art style and sort of a fictional premise.
Well, you could play it with a gamepad, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like you, maybe you should.
Yeah, it's even. Split-screen gamepad. It's. Yeah. I'm very excited to dive into this. Mostly because I'm a Redwall fan, but also because it just looks ludicrous, and I don't have time to, you know, understand every RTS that comes out anymore. So that's Tooth and Tail.
Yeah. So my question is, what sort of separates Tooth and Tail from basically like your run-of-the-mill MOBA? Like,
sure.
Oh.
Well, for one thing, I don't think there's an emphasis on like character abilities or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So you're truly building an army,
okay. And
you have a base that you maintain. So you have sort of these farm plots, as I remember. I haven't played the game in about a year, so
yeah,
apologies.
It's been a while for me too.
But you know, your animals are sort of accruing these resources. You have this mm-hmm. Sort of, you know, barn structure or windmill, and you're deciding, you know, do I want to build the thing that creates badgers, or do I want to build the thing that creates falcons?
Okay.
You know, because they have different, as units on the battlefield, they have different kind of strengths and weaknesses and rock, paper, scissors style counters.
So the units will still sort of spawn similar to like a creep wave or something, but you're kind of picking what it is you want to build and go and stuff like that.
I would say it's more like you're rallying units that you have in place with a single click of a button, mm-hmm. and they auto follow you around the map.
Gotcha.
Yes. Yeah. As opposed to like, they don't just
trickling.
Exactly. Yeah, so you're like, when you're ready, you sort of hoover up your guys into a ball and run forward with them, and you win or lose, you come back and make some more.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
Your character's a very elaborate cursor in a way, but I do check it out. It's released maybe yesterday, today. I'm excited to try it. Moving on, Bo, did you have any news? I don't know if you had any news.
News? Not really. I've just been playing a lot of XCOM, so that's like jam.
Let's get to that. But before we get to that, I want to. If you guys been playing anything besides XCOM,
sure have, James.
What's that?
Quake Champions. I know you've been playing it too.
Yeah, maybe less so this last week, but
yeah,
it's taken me by surprise. Maybe it shouldn't have because it's Quake. But what do you think so far?
Well, I mean, this kind of feeds in the conversation we were having a moment ago, where there's so much happening on PC that we're like, okay, not the second coming. I mean, how many Quake games are there? There's Quake 4, there's Arena, there's Quake Live. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's like the sixth coming of Quake or something. You know, what should be so like this major event for the platform.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it's failed or anything like that
no.
At all, but it's sort of like, it's just another game among many. You know, Quake, the purest competitive multiplayer FPS that's ever existed. And we're like, oh, okay, it's an early access. Like, I'll check it out. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's free to play. It's actually like quite good. All right, you know, it's not a phenomenon instantly, which it's just amazing. It shows like the level of fragmentation of people playing all these different things and the competition for attention that there is. Anyway, so yeah, this came out in early access before PAX.
Right.
It's a free to play game on Bethesda's platform.
Yes.
The Bethesda launcher. Is that really what it's called? Am I remembering right? Right? I don't know. I don't actually use it anymore.
No.
Now that Elder Scrolls Legends is on Steam. Anyway, you pay $30 on Steam and you get all the characters that you would otherwise have to buy if you were playing it for free. I think there's about 9 of them,
something like that, yeah.
Or something. And again, like the key, if you're a big Quake player, the big differences are there's variable health and armor totals, capacities, I should say, for the different characters. And the characters, yes, have some kind of ultimate ability or active ability, I think is more accurate. Sure. And they do have often like different passive abilities or different styles of movement, right? Where one of the characters accelerates by like just bunny hopping continuously in a straight line, whereas another one can double jump or another one can straight jump, you know? So you have the different kind of flavors of movement there accessible to you. But I think for me, it's, you know, I put about 20 hours into it and I've had a really good time. It's Quake ultimately, like despite all this, there's a ton of cosmetic stuff later in the game maybe I can rant on in a second, but it walks and talks like Quake. I mean, that's like my immediate impression. It's a game you want to play at like 120 plus hertz if you can. You know, it's got the movement down, I think. It's got, you know, the weapons are all there and like well preserved. You can argue with these nuances like, well, the rockets don't have quite as wide a splash damage radius and that affects the game in X and Y way, but like it's Quake, you know, and it's Quake in 2017 with, yes, a lot of microtransaction stuff layered into it. Yes, like variable characters, but I'm okay with that. Like I can more than tolerate all that stuff for the fun of bunny hopping, using railgun, hitting people in midair with rockets, you know, using teleporters, all those kind of gimmicks are really well in place.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people have concern about these active abilities, as you call them. Have you found those to be a point of frustration or interesting in any way? Like how do they add or detract, or they just kind of fall into the background when you're playing?
Yeah. It's something I continue to grapple with.
Yeah.
I think moment to moment, they do frustrate sometimes, you know, when you're in this duel with, there's a character called Sorlag. It's this kind of giant lizard character. Yeah. I actually saw a lot of play in the recent Quake World Championships at QuakeCon last month. Anywho. And yeah, like you're in this duel with them, you're trading rockets. I hit you, you hit me. Oh, who's going to win? And then they spray you with acid and you just die instantly. You're like, you know, okay, that's on a cooldown. Okay. Like they spent their big special ability to kind of turn the tide there. In that moment, yes, you're like, oh, okay, dude, I get it. But honestly, more than anything, I get why they distributed the different movement styles across the different characters and kind of siloed them into it. Like, okay, this is the bunny hopping character in a straight line, you know, as I was describing, you know, this is the one that if you just want to not worry about movement mechanics at all, you just want to have a lot of tankiness. I get that because Quake is a very intimidating game. And like, there's a real argument for making it more accessible, honestly. And I honestly think they've tread the line pretty well. Again, if you watch any of the recent Quake World Championships, it was an entertaining game to watch. I mean, the highest skill players in the world made it really fun. And what was interesting in the duel system, it's almost like a draft, right? In League of Legends or something, where you pick three characters and the other guy picks three characters. So you do have these interesting kind of asymmetries between them where, okay, now I'm the very fragile character who can disappear and make themselves invulnerable any moment versus the durable character who can spit acid. Like who's going to win that matchup, right? Because there's advantage and disadvantage in different ways at the outset. I think for me as a spectator, that made it interesting.
Hmm.
I mean, okay. It's really sort of, how pure do you want your Quake to be, you know? So I don't know. I found it to be fine. And I've come to enjoy these abilities and sort of recognizing the characters and learning how to counter them on the maps.
In my limited time, I agree. Your abilities and the character differences frustrate from time to time, only because I'm unfamiliar with them, at least initially. But they have at least been interesting articulations on a game that I've played for the better part of, you know, my life. So I'm not angry about that.
Like it doesn't take away from the thrill of railing somebody.
Not at all.
At high speed from a long distance. You know, it doesn't take away from rocket jumping and hitting consecutive midair rockets or getting the quad damage and hitting somebody with a lightning gun and going on a spree. Like that's all there. Mm-hmm. That's not like canceled out or muddled in any way, I think.
No.
So I really encourage people, if you like high skill shooters, there's no reason you shouldn't be playing Quake Champions right now.
I agree.
It's in great shape.
At the very least, when it is free to play, give it a shot. Because, you know, I think it is a very good platform, Quake platform, for now and into the next however many years it's able to exist. And it has some just bonkers layers of cosmetic items and crate drops.
And crazy.
It's insane. There are challenges that you unlock by getting backpacks, which are like the smallest loot chests.
There's three tiers of loot chests.
Yes.
There's three tiers of currency.
Why?
It's kind of ridiculous. None of it is very important. Unless you really want to express yourself.
Are you saying it's not important to look like Doom Guy from the original Doom?
It's very important to look like Doom Guy. Actually, the Ranger has this... I'm going to get this. This is what I consider finishing Quake Champions right now, is getting the Rangers' quarterback uniform.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Some really cool cosmetics that are just silly, silly stuff.
But in order to get it...
Yeah. Oh, gosh. It's the rune? Is that the rune challenge?
The loot scrolls.
The loot scrolls.
Okay, so... So there's a store, right? I mean, just as you'd expect, there's a store for cosmetic items, and you can buy chests and stuff, and they give you epic, legendary, whatever, whatever. You can buy the original Quake rocket launcher. You can buy the Quake 2 railgun as a cosmetic item, and that makes sense. There's weapon skins, character skins. You know, there's torso pieces and all this kind of stuff. Separate from all of that are these sort of above legendary costumes, so like full suits for each character, that you can only get by going into a match, and within each map there are like these breakable kind of vases and other like boxes and stuff like that scattered around in each map. In one of those breakable jugs is a lore scroll. All right. Only one. It's randomly placed. Okay? And in order to unlock that costume, you need to find 10 lore scrolls for that character. When you find a lore scroll, it's random which character it's for. Yep, it's not, it could be for character A or character C or D or whatever. So, again, I mean, this is like one of the things that just confuses the hell out of me with Quake Champions. It's one of the most pure competitive games that's ever existed. And you're asking me to look for a piece of a cosmetic thing
in the middle of the game,
of a match. You can't do it during warm up. You have to do it during combat, essentially. And it's a distraction. Like, I see my teammates like shooting these jugs and I'm like, dude, like get the quad damage, So I understand why they did it, cynically, I get it. But it's a baffling fit for a game with that heritage to be asked to sort of Easter egg hunt within a brutal deathmatch.
Yeah, there's so many better ways to do it. Just a random person gets it, or if you achieve a, I don't know, but whatever. It's at least funny to look at from a distance.
It's bizarre.
Bo, you been playing anything else besides?
For a while, I was playing a lot of Absolver.
We
chatted about that a fair bit. I've put probably like maybe 20 or 30 hours into that game, and I got to the point where I had pretty much beaten the main game, was starting to dive into the online matches and playing other people, and I was just like, oh, wait, I'm terrible at this. I've never been good at fighting games, and the amount of time I'm going to have to pour into this to grind into this, like not even just unlocking move, like for a while I was having fun grinding the game, just unlocking moves, like going and beating up the NPCs because that's how you unlock your different combat styles and different combat moves, and I was having fun with that, just like getting better and like stringing stuff together. But then I realized, like, okay, that's like your in-game character's skill. But that hadn't really improved me as a player, my skill, very much. Yeah. And the amount of time I was going to have to pour into that game to get good was immense. And I was just like, you know what?
Wow.
I'm just going to...
But hold on. I mean, I know at the outset of the game, you pick like a fighting style, and there's sort of like an easy, medium, and hard one, right?
Sort of. Yeah. I'm not sure if they are. Yeah. They might be a little bit, yeah.
But they're still deep, you would say.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Each one, basically, I wasn't aware that each one of them was like an easy, medium, hard or something. I just picked the one that appealed to me, which I feel like most people picked. It was like the wind one. Yeah, yeah. I think everybody picked that one. And I'm not sure if that was considered the easy, medium, or hard one. either way, like I picked that. But yeah, like once even within that, you only have a handful of moves, and you have to like unlock a whole bunch of them in addition to that. And you can like unlock moves outside of that one combat style. So like the combat style itself only really pertains to what your like counter dodge ability is. Like the wind style is a dodge. One of them is like a parry, and one of them is like an absorb type thing. And so to like unlock those alternate basically like your single dodge, you have to do a lot of training and like join a school to do all this, but you can use the moves from the other schools while you're in this one. So yeah, that's all the like leveling up I did of my character. And also I was only probably like level 30 or so of the in-game character out of like 60. So I had a long way to go in terms of character leveling up.
Right.
But I also had a long, long, long way to go in terms of me personally getting better. And
well, it's interesting because we got a theme going on today. Evan brought up these skyscraper games, and Absolver, for it to, is sort of like poised to, it's built around, you know, sustaining a multiplayer base and being a thing that ideally I would imagine more moves come to and so on and so forth.
I absolutely could see that game having a long lifespan if, you know, assuming they add content to it and that it continues to have like a healthy player base and. Because it's, you know, it has these online matchmaking battles in the same way that, you know, games like Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom and stuff have. And they have very healthy competitive communities. And these 1v1 matches are pretty much exactly the same, except for the way the matches play out are totally different because it's a 3D combat and you're the whole game, the mechanics are different.
Yeah.
But yeah, like having no background in fighting games, like not knowing basically just button mashing to get my way through, I was able to play the game and have a lot of fun with it and start to kind of pick up the beginnings of the, like, you know, deeper
where the real tiers. Game starts.
Yeah, where the real game starts, exactly.
Yeah.
But in order to actually reach that next level, for me at least, it was going to take a lot of time. And I had this moment where I realized this is not
Overwatch.
Probably not going to be a skyscraper game for me. Like Overwatch is my skyscraper game. Like, and I'm having fun with this, but I don't really need to pour a ton of time into it for something that's basically only going to be, the skill set is only going to be used for this game. So unless I want to make this my one game.
Yeah.
I went back to Overwatch. And then I started playing XCOM and like 40 hours later.
I mean, I'd be curious to hear when we get to Q&A, you know, is that something that our audience feels like they have to make that same decision, right? Like they can only kind of make a big investment in one game and they can kind of have these side games on the side that they tinker with. I'm curious if people would frame it that way.
I mean, you know, before we move on too much, I would say at least with, say, like shooters, you're still, even if you're playing a different game, you're still maintaining that like aim tracking, match decision making. You know, you might not, there's differences in Overwatch between like managing ult economy and like tracking all these different things, and versus TF2 or Battlegrounds is a different type of shooter. And it's at least the kind of the same base skill set,
marksmanship.
Exactly. and same thing, like moving from one MOBA to another, even like card games, people who are good at, like, some of the foremost Hearthstone pros are like former Magic pros and stuff like that. And so these skills carry over from game to game within the same genre. And for all I know, it's possible that being really good at Street Fighter might give you a big leg up on Absolver. There's probably a lot of carryover there, even though it is relatively a different fighting type game. But yeah, me not having that background in fighting games, I would have basically have to become done a for. Big fighting game player to get there.
Fair enough. Real quickly, before I just talk about Destiny 2 for the rest of the show, just kidding, I'll take like 5 minutes, I swear. Max Ursa has just subscribed for 15 months in a row. So
wow, welcome yeah, back.
We're getting a lot of these like over year, 2 year subscribers now, and it's starting to freak me out. I'm just going to blink and Max Ursa will be subscribed for, I don't know, 100 months. I'll be old and gray. Yep. What does this get me? 15 months, baby. What does that get me? Our ongoing love and support.
Yeah.
We really appreciate it.
Real appreciation.
Super, super appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is a PC gaming show, so I'm not going to spend too much time on Destiny 2. But I just do want to, because we are, you know, we're tortured with waiting for the PC release, which is coming out October 24th. A good month and a half or so after the console release. I figured I would at least allay some fears, or at least, you know, tell people that it's very good. And knowing what we know about the PC version, that it, at least the beta, runs super well, pretty scalable, and has, you know, all the bells and whistles we sort of expect, FOV and some cool post-processing effects and mouse and keyboard controls.
The mouse and keyboard feels really good. It
feels
right?
really good.
Nice.
You can tell they going, you know, I when I first played it at the reveal event, I went back and forth between the two quite a bit, and you can really tell that the PC aiming is specifically tuned for mouse and keyboard, like the recoil on, you know, the console versus PC. Anyway, what struck me most about the campaign, having played through it, the bulk of the main game, the sort of starting path from level 1 to 20, is that this feels a lot like a Halo game. And that shouldn't come as a surprise, really.
Right? Strange.
Right. Coming from Bungie.
Yeah.
But the first Destiny campaign was sort of a hollow, kind of quiet, somewhat unfinished feeling thing. And there's a lot of reasons. You can read all sorts of stories about the troubled, like, late development of that game. This time around, the campaign, the primary campaign, which is one of many things you can do in that game, is very loud and sort of a huge space opera with big dumb bads and
pretty into that.
You know, a silent hero and tank missions. Here and there, you know, cool vehicle missions.
Cool vehicle missions.
They're
tolerable. I guess Halo missions. Halo does have some interesting vehicles.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah. And none of it is like in a game like Destiny, where the progression is all about sort of playing as your character, and, you know, showing, expressing yourself through your weapon choice, your class choice, and how you spec those out. You would think a vehicle mission or two or three is like kind of beside the point. But it, in the context of the game, it like works, and it makes for some thrilling set pieces that really surprised me. And I think one of the biggest things I want to touch on before moving on is that I think the scale of the game, the encounter design, how many enemies can appear on screen at once, is especially what made it feel like a Halo game for me. And The previous game, having not been on, or it was sort of beholden to the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360, because they were developing it for those platforms at the same time. Now that it's like the current gen consoles and PC, you can have these huge like scale battles. There's dozens of enemies on screen at once. You're jumping around this giant like spaceship, or, you know, some kind of frigate landing platform, and there's four different races like going at it with different, like, you know, enemy types within those races. And it would be almost fun to watch from the top down, because it's just interesting to see, you know, that kind of sandbox first person shooting that, you know, from those first Halo games that we've sorely missed on the PC. It's definitely here with that, you know, with progression and loot and all these things that may turn the traditional first person shooter fan off. But I think, if everything goes smoothly, this is going to be a really big hit for a lot of people. And it might take a lot of people by surprise, especially if they had heard about Destiny 1 and like the sore shape it was in at launch. And they decide to pick this up, or, you know, look into it. I think there's going to going to be a lot to enjoy, especially once we see what the raid is like, which is out today on consoles, and I assume will be out at launch. Well, maybe not at launch on the PC, but shortly after.
Cool.
Excuse me. Anyway, that's Destiny 2. I won't keep talking about it. Let's talk about the game we all have been playing and are all desperate to talk about. Can you guess what it's called? It's called XCOM 2.
Yeah.
XCOM 2, War of the Chosen.
War of the Chosen. War of the
XCOM 2 has been out for a while. It was very ranked very highly on our top 100. Mm-hmm. It's one of our favorite games.
I think rightly so.
And the expansion pack, War of the Chosen, just came out about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, I think.
Something like that, yeah.
Long enough that each of us have been playing it for a pretty considerable amount of time at this point.
Yeah, I took, like, well, I haven't played it consecutively because I hopped into Destiny and been trying to, you know, figure mm-hmm. that out. But I played, like, I had a Saturday. And this is what I do with Fire Access games is I say I'm going to sit down for 2 hours. I'm like, yeah, I'll check out this expansion. I'm sure it's got some cool things. I've heard, you know, the Chosen sound cool. Literally, like, 12 hours later, I was done playing that for the day.
I've found there's something about XCOM in particular. I haven't played a lot of other games from the developer, like, that.
Civ?
I mean, actually, no, I didn't.
What?
I'm not a Civ person. All
right.
But, you know, having said that, there's something about these games that they never really feel like there's a stopping point. Like, you, even if you're at, like, the end of a chapter, which would say, like, at the end of a mission or at the start of a mission almost, like, you know, you have your build phase and then your mission phase. But, like, the second you finish the mission, you immediately feel like you need to go and do some stuff. And then I'm like, well, I'll just scan for a minute to get this next thing. And then, like, an next mission happens. Like, well, I'll just do this mission. And all of a sudden, yeah, it's like 8 hours later. And it feels like a book that where every chapter ends on a cliffhanger almost. And I'm taking a leaf out of a friend of mine. Recently, she's rewatching Game of Thrones actually watching it for the first time all the way through. And she said that the way that she's been able to stop watching it is she always stops in the middle of an episode instead of like, because at the end of the episode, it's always a cliffhanger. She wants to play the next one.
Oh,
so this is my pro tip for being able to stop playing XCOM is like stop in the middle of a mission, like kill a group of enemies. You get a quick break and then just like save and quit and.
Yeah, because the game gives you work, right? I mean, the game gives you these little chores you have to do.
Yeah.
Okay, I got intel. Oh, I need to spend that intel. I could really use a new PCS for this guy to boost his health. Oh, this guy got injured. I need to build an infirmary. Okay, mm-hmm. I need supplies for an infirmary. I'm going to scan for those supplies. Oh, I need to unlock this region to help me get more supplies throughout the whole game. Oh, I unlocked this new research that's going to allow me to get this guy. Oh, I need another sharpshooter. I'm going to go train a sharpshooter in my training center.
So much.
You know, there's all these like interconnected relationships between stuff. It's really clever. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm in the end game of my campaign right now. And I mean, I think even more so than the original game, it's really easy to just sort of grind it, honestly. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to keep the Avatar project progress down. There's this whole... what are they called? Like the undercover missions?
Yeah, the covert actions.
Covert actions, yeah. I really love that system. But you can specifically just like take away from the Avatar project progress. Mm-hmm. I feel like one of the biggest pieces of feedback those guys acted on was that people really dislike timers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
not only just in terms of the Avatar project, but within missions.
Yeah.
I think those seem to be cut out of a lot of different mission
they
types.
They were in like the majority of missions in the original release.
Yeah.
And this time...
Yeah, not many. And when they are there, they are either generous or there are things that you can like add some of the covert action, what are they called? The resistance orders. Like there's ones, basically there's things that you can spec into in order to lengthen or make those timers go even more favorably for you. Because like I understand the need for timers because it obviously makes the mission more challenging.
Yeah.
But like a big part of playing XCOM, especially on harder difficulties, is like moving incredibly slow and being incredibly calculated about every single move. And when you need to do that in order to survive, and yet the game is telling you to go fast, it creates this dissonance that was not always fun, basically.
Right. Let's talk about The Chosen. I think that's
the best part.
The best part and one of the biggest additions to the game. I think for me, XCOM 2 is now about The Chosen.
Yep.
even though you can ignore them to some extent, you know, you don't have to defeat them in order to complete the game. They are sort of these, I don't know, generals that are, you know, prowling around the map. If you're completely unfamiliar with War of the Chosen, yeah, there's these three sort of mega enemies, mega villains that they've introduced that they each kind of own a different part of the map. And if you go on missions there, you have a chance of encountering them. So they'll like teleport into the map, say something really mean, and then, like, you know, blast up your guys with all their crazy powers. So in order to defeat them, like, first of all, I think it's like really interesting and cool that, you know, you face off one of these guys for the first time and you're fighting them. It's a struggle, right? Because you weren't planning on encountering this new big threat. They have like very unique strengths and weaknesses that you have to sort of wrap your head around. Maybe you didn't bring the right guys to this mission, right? It's like a lot of pressure at once. You're trying to complete this other objective. And then, okay, you make all these sacrifices, your guys are beat up, and you knock them out, right? But they don't actually die.
It just warps away.
Right. Yeah, they just teleport away, and you're like, and this happens again and again. Like, they show up, and you're like, they're not dying. And then you figure out, oh, I have to do all the stuff in the metagame and the world map to find their base, and then create this mission to go to their base, and that's like a really tough mission to actually kill them, right? So, man, like, that's such an interesting structure by itself. They're annoying you. They're this like really, they're more than a mosquito. I don't know, like a raccoon or something, you know, like knocking over garbage can every night. And until you deal with that raccoon, it's going to keep getting into your garbage. Yeah. And you're trying to take, I'm not going to extend this further than I have to. More than that though, I think what they do is they finally give XCOM's enemies, like this adversary that you're facing throughout the game, a voice.
Yep.
And you think that, well, the elders, you know, these sort of really tall, lanky psychic aliens or whatever they are, they had English voices in the previous game, but they weren't really in your face, you know. They're in cutscenes, and okay, they'll say a thing or two in the final mission, but otherwise what you got was the Avent talking in their kind of alien Simlish, you know, squawking to you and stuff that you can't really make up, and they're clones, they're literal clones. Yeah. The Advent, you know, and mutons, or they all kind of look alike, whatever. And you sort of just understood them through their mechanics and their personality and their sort of the way they emote in those little mini cutscenes when they reveal themselves. And those are all good, but you never felt like they had true personalities. Oh my God, these Chosen have personalities. It's excellent, right?
Yeah. I think it's a, when they harry you one or two times, and once they initially kill or seriously maim or hurt one of your people, all the while insulting you, all of a sudden XCOM has personal stakes instead of these kind of blurry, just, you know what XCOM is, you're going to save the world, save people, yada yada, stakes. And even though they're sort of the most stereotypical villains you could possibly imagine in the context of this game, I would be angry at them if they were villains in almost any other thing. I'd be like, that's stupid. But it works. Like, they are here. Like, XCOM is hard enough as it is, and you're going to get your ass kicked and your heart broken in many ways before the time is over. Now you have, like, these bullies who are telling you you're
cyberbullying.
And they're coming in with abilities that subvert habits you've probably been depending on for several games now.
Yeah. So, for example, they might develop a total immunity to explosives. I mean, if you play it XCOM 2 at all, you know how
are your best friend.
You know how powerful like proximity mines are and stuff, and just how they get you out of so many tough situations. And you're like, well, I guess that's off the table. I guess grenadiers are just not an option anymore. Cool. And then you have to build your characters and build a group that, like, a strike team that can take those guys out, right? But yeah, they're just so ever present, and they have so much to say. You know,
I mean, something that I really like about them is it basically, they're a reliable and like well-built boss enemy for XCOM. Like in previous these XCOM games, like there hasn't really, like there have been really strong enemies that you have to fight. There's like the Sectopod, and there's like other big things that have a lot of health and do a lot of damage. But maybe it's because they didn't really have a voice. Like the enemies, they just felt like a big kind of meat shield that you had to take down a bunch of health while dodging their crazy powerful attacks. And they often, because they were just these big things, they didn't feel like you were really playing XCOM the game. Like, there's a lot of games that have really great regular mission combat, but then fail to translate that combat into boss fights. Like,
yeah.
Deus Ex had this problem in a big way with Human Revolution. Like, it had really great, you know, man-to-man combat, but the boss encounters just don't really work. And so for this, it takes XCOM combat of moving from cover to cover, like flanking your shots, lining up your abilities, all this stuff, and putting it into a boss fight that still feels like you're playing XCOM and not changing it in a drastic way. And that's something that I really liked about it.
I think it also checks the box. I mean, all those games that you're mentioning, one of the issues that they have is, you know, you go through these levels or missions or whatever, and then the boss is at the very end in a room or something, right? And they're all in this, you know, big, expansive, cliched, like, boss-looking room. And that's kind of your only interaction with them. Maybe you see them in a cutscene beforehand or something. Whereas The Chosen, like good villains in media, think about just Darth Vader and A New Hope or something, the protagonist encounters them halfway through the film or something. Mm-hmm. They have chances to talk to them and interact and sort of spar, right? There's a history that builds up, and then it culminates in this final battle.
Exactly.
Like, so many games fail to do that because they only think about the mechanics of the boss fight, right? Mm-hmm. And they think about, well, I guess I need to throw sort of some, like, lieutenant enemies and sort of mini bosses at this guy, and then we'll end up, you know, fighting the big bad at the end. Think about BioShock, for example,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And what a mistake that was. So I love that these guys talk to you while you're just doing stuff on the main map. You know, they appear
There's no escape.
Metal Gear Solid style radio faces, you know. I love that the specificity of their voice lines too. I don't want to spoil anything. So say, insert, you may be able to bring like a really special weapon into battle, and they'll comment on that, like this unique weapon that you're able to field, and sort of, and it's always something arrogant. It's always something like, if a character gets wounded, they'll comment on it afterwards and say like, oh, that must really hurt, basically. and like, I think you put it well, James. It's very much like mustache twirling.
Yeah,
you know,
they're pretty cheesy, but it works.
I'll get you next time, XCOM. It does work, and they're not very different. Like, The Chosen all kind of have the same attitude, but I really enjoyed killing them. I really enjoyed,
because it has such a, it just a rippling effect through everything you do in that game. A, like you said, it becomes about The Chosen, because from the strategy layer, you're considering the Avatar project and all these things you normally do, and your typical research and chores and yada yada. But almost everything I did was, at least shortly into the game, funneled or done in consideration of working towards finding the researching their kill Your mission base. Basically.
Yeah, because they're like doing the game puts pressure on you, because independently, I think this is interesting.
Yeah.
Each of the Chosen are like doing their homework on you, right? There's this, they each have progress bar that's like literally their knowledge on XCOM and where you're at. And one, I actually haven't had them hit 100 yet, but
so close.
When it happens, I think they raid your base or something. There's probably a special mission there, or you lose something.
Something like that. Yeah. I think they gain new abilities, or at least strengths, or, you know, something like that. It's horrifying what can it almost feels like they are playing the game on the other side of the screen.
Yes.
That is super motivating to me, and it makes it feel, I think, because they are so omnipresent in that game, when you finally do take one out, it makes the strategy layer, there's a huge noticeable effect, because suddenly an entire country is yours. You have to worry so much less to worry about in a specific space. And you feel like you've made progress, as opposed to, like, you're still spinning plates, but you're not spinning this one huge plate anymore. And it's so rewarding.
Not only that, the actual rewards are pretty great too. I don't want to say anything. I don't want to spoil them, but they trickle the rewards to you, in that when you kill them, and they're respawnable modes, like you get a big boost of XP or AP, the Games yeah. version, and so it's like you feel like you're getting something. It's a nice accomplishment every time you take them out, and then yeah, when you finally do, I don't want to say what it is, but like it's pretty sweet.
Well, I love that you can lose that too.
Oh yeah,
if it's on a character and they die,
yeah, shit,
it's gone. If like you leave them behind, yeah,
makes sense.
Really good stuff. We should also talk about the loss a little bit, and I think one of the other great strengths or improvements, I guess, the War of the Chosen makes XCOM mm-hmm. 2 is just mission variety. Mm-hmm. I definitely got tired of the mission types I was sent on in the original XCOM 2. Just go get this VIP. I don't like those missions very much. You know, kill all these guys, kill all these guys, kill all these guys. I love the resistance missions. Mm. So
on the resistance missions, I just want to say, I think the single greatest thing that they added to this game is the fact that the resistance fighters can shoot.
Oh my God.
It's amazing. Yes.
And they're, and
such
they
a relief.
They kill so much shit.
They kill a bunch of dudes.
They're really competent. Like I'm like cheering them on.
Like, yes. Cause it finally feels like, oh, I'm helping my allies get something done rather than like swooping in and defending these useless people.
Yeah. And it introduces more variables, right? Because you're like, oh man, well, is the resistance going to take care of that muton in the corner, or do I have to kind of get there and rescue them, right? So yeah, on these missions, there were sort of like these little clusters of civilians in, you know, these dingy camps, basically, poor them. And they're guarded by these armed civilians, like say maybe four of them or five of them at max on the map. And, you know, they're taking their own independent moves. They're maybe doing 3 or 6 damage. They might crit, you know, on their own, and you feel that little burst of like, wait, way to go, little guy, way to go, man. Maybe you'll join XCOM someday, you know? And yeah, there's, that adds a whole nother texture, but again, it's sort of this third faction. You're allied with them. And similarly, the missions were the loss, which they're just zombies effectively, mm-hmm, yeah, you know, in their large hordes of, I wouldn't call them weak, but you know, simple,
squishy
enemies in XCOM 2. I think I've only seen them in the urban area maps, which are...
I've seen them in a city type thing.
Yeah. Okay, so...
urban, yeah.
And that's like a whole different kind of map aesthetic that I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. But so when you shoot one of these lost or zombie characters, if you kill it on that same turn, you get that turn refunded. Mm-hmm. So you're able to...
That action.
So you're able to chain together a lot of kills as long as you keep ammo. So then you're thinking about, how can I build XCOM squad members who are really good at sort of taking a lot of shots and hitting them, right? So you're thinking about big magazines, accuracy, and stuff like that, getting in close.
Pistols are awesome,
you know,
by the way, because they don't have ammo.
Yep. Exactly. So that opens things up. But again, there are these circumstances where you're fighting the Advent and the Lost are there, and the Lost will attack the Advent. Mm-hmm. They're not allied. I love those missions. And likewise, so the covert actions, sometimes there's a risk of the people that you send on those covert actions will be ambushed, and then you have to do this sort of two-character micro mission to get them to an extraction zone, and that's super fun, right? Because you're just focused on managing two characters, and it sort of becomes this almost like cinematic escape movie or something. And they've done a great job of just increasing the total variety in that game of stuff.
It's incredible. I'm so excited to get back into it and finally get that goddamn sniper chosen. He's been harassing me. I wish we could talk about it forever. I do want to shout out the challenge mode. Have you guys tried the challenge mode?
I haven't played it, but I read and saw some about it.
Yeah.
Read a little thing.
If you're worried about spending all day playing XCOM, just instead try the challenge mode. These are, I don't know if they reset daily or how often. I would imagine daily at this point. You have a timer of 30 minutes. You have a pre-assigned map and enemy layout and suite of soldiers, and you go. You get things, you get points for killing enemies, achieving the objective, time spent, a bonus. And it's really cool, just sort of like a bite-size, renewable XCOM experience that I'm awful at, but I enjoy at the very least. So that's a
and cool. you score points, and then there's like global leaderboards. And stuff forward. Yeah,
and you can watch the replays from all those. Oh, we watched the replay of the top one on the stream last week, and it was a hacker, very clearly a hacker. were invincible. So I don't know how that's going to work in the long term, but for Axis, you know, just keep your eye out, please. anyway, moving on. Excuse me. You guys, there's been some controversy this week.
No.
What? How do you spell this guy's name? I said Pie Die Pie.
Yeah, almost.
You've got it.
Almost.
You've got
there it is.
I know it's.
So
can't keep these YouTubers straight.
Oh my gosh, this is quite the story. So, do you guys know who PewDiePie is?
PewDiePie.
Oh god.
Apparently.
Well, he's a very popular YouTuber. He's the most popular YouTuber, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah,
he's the most popular YouTuber by subscribers in the world.
He's a massive celebrity, especially among younger people, I would imagine. But recently, he, on a stream, said a racial slur out loud. Real bad one. The worst, arguably. But it's, for a guy who has such a platform, that's a huge no-no in the eyes of many, many people, obviously. And in response to this, a lot of developers, specifically Campo Santo, who developed Firewatch, said, we are going to file a DMCA and get our videos on his channel taken down. And the outcry after this was, or at least the confused outcry was, yeah, is that legal? Do they have, the precedent to do that? And is it right? All these questions sort of emerged. A lot of developers followed suit and said the same thing. So kind of this dogpiling effect, like, we don't want to be associated, our game, our copyright, we don't want that associated with someone who is a racist.
Yeah.
And Tyler, I'll post the link in chat here. Maybe you guys can kind of talk about the legalities of it.
So
a nice write-up about this after talking to a lawyer.
Yeah, so we there's a lot of different sides of this issue, and we should also mention that Mr. Pie has he's apologized. Yes. He's in a monetized video issued an apology, as is the without being too cynical, like, I am really sick of this sort of cycle of a big YouTuber makes a mistake and then like all these people sort of create this. Because YouTube rewards related videos and the algorithm, mm-hmm. Because you want to piggyback on something that's going to get a lot of traffic, right? Mm-hmm. So all these other people sort of pile on to add their own commentary and stuff like that. Maybe we're not so different. I don't know. I feel like we're just reporting on what's happened and how it affects our audience.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But yeah, anyway, so again, this is totally legal.
That's the conclusion.
Yeah.
They totally can do whatever they want with their copyright.
So, again, if you think about Firewatch, sort of its assets, its material, like, when you buy a game like Firewatch, you don't own that game per se. You're licensing it, right? And the developers granted you a license. That's sort of a one-way street. And the developer can revoke your license to stream that game, essentially, to sort of use that material in a way that they're uncomfortable with for any reason. It's not like a two-way binding legal contract or anything.
Yeah,
so,
unless that license says non-revocable somewhere in there, then for any reason they can pull it.
Exactly.
Or at least file it.
And of course, a lot of folks bring up fair use, which is, again, not like a worldwide concept, we should say. No, like,
varies country to country.
For example, fair use kind of doesn't exist in Australia, as I understand it. Like, parody is your only defense in instances where you're using copywritten material. But yeah, like, say you're, okay, broadly, it's the reason that, like, a local TV news show can like show a clip from a recent film, right? Because they're commenting on it, they're saying like, hey this just came out, even though it's copyrighted material, under this sort of umbrella of commentary and criticism, they're protected, even though they're actually infringing, but they're protected under this thing that takes greater precedent, which is fair use. But in actuality, there's a lot of discussion and debate whether something like a Let's Play constitutes a fair use.
Yeah, is it transformative enough?
Yeah, exactly. That's sort of the legal guideline, right? Like, if for example, I don't know, God, I'm like thinking back to my college copyright law classes now. The measure by which like something's considered fair use is, are you sort of transforming that work, right? So in other words, you're not simply taking it and putting it on another platform. You're not sort of like taking someone's photo, taking like, you know, the entirety of Game of Thrones and putting it on YouTube. You're taking a little bit of Game of Thrones and like making a parody of it. You're transforming it, or, you know, you're making it into a music video, or you're making like a fun comedy reel or something, right? You're doing something with it that is original and putting your own spin on it, right? Some lawyers believe that a Let's Play doesn't constitute like transformation of a work, right? If I'm just sort of taking a game and taking, like in the case of Firewatch, you know, several hours of that game, you could just put that all on YouTube in one clip if you wanted, right? In one video. So that's kind of where the argument stands right here. You know, it's worth saying that like there hasn't been a court case specifically centered around games and, and Let's Plays and fair use. So it hasn't sort of been formally decided in a court of law in the US, but
It's all currently like interpretation of laws that were decided upon for cases of other mediums, basically, and it's being interpreted and applied to these specific cases, which is, I mean, how the legal system works. But until we have a case that specifically deals with this specific situation, it will all just be these different interpretations, basically.
But that's sort of all to say that Camposanto isn't truly kind of breaking or creating a legal precedent. It's more that they're it's more that like developers have simply kind of been tolerating, if I can put it that way. They've been tolerating Let's Plays because Let's Plays are,
and frankly, they're good for the developer.
Exactly, in their interest in a lot of ways. It's marketing, it's putting information out there. I mean, you can argue like, is a Let's Play of a Telltale game really helping or hurting because people can just watch it instead of playing it, for example. There's that sort of tug of war. But any developer could have done this at any time. And actually, you know, developers have done it before. And it's this is like, so like Jim Sterling's a more prominent case, right? He was critical about a game and that prompted a developer to sort of try and take down his video. So yeah, it's a complicated question. I guess, you know, I'm certainly not crazy about the idea of developers being able to sort of inhibit discussion of games in any way, you know, but frankly, like, hopefully this will sort of get the conversation going and sort of help people to understand and realize like Let's Plays and similar YouTube video content, it's like a very fragile, you know, like legally vulnerable thing to be doing. And hopefully the law will catch up, as it often takes a long time to do, especially when it comes to technology. But but really, I guess like that's what I would want to impress on people, that like this is like revealing an issue that exists. You know, not sort of creating a problem. Camposanto isn't sort of instigating something or even abusing a system, I would say. I think that's totally inaccurate. It's really sort of they're acting something that's like on a tool that's always existed. And frankly, like, you know, YouTube and that, and the system is to blame in a huge way, because YouTube, you know, they don't, if you paid any attention to the way YouTube has interacted with content creators and ad companies over the past year or two, like it's really easy to tell like where YouTube's loyalty and sort of, you know, agenda lies. And that is appeasing corporations and the people that pay them at all turns, which is why they've built a system for them to, you know, act on copyright strikes and stuff like that, rather than, anyway, that's a whole nother kind of can of worms.
I think the big takeaway here is for people on who are worried about this being the signal light of the end of YouTube, video game YouTube as we know it, to calm down. That this is, like you said, Evan, this is going to get a conversation going, and hopefully, you know, develop some kind of standard going forward that will, well, ideally protect everyone, in, you know, and educate, I think, a lot of YouTubers on what exactly their livelihood is built around, and what maybe they should strive for in their content. So we'll see. We'll see. It's going to be an interesting thing to follow, I think, certainly. But sit tight.
Yeah. In the meantime, you know, if you have millions of children as your audience, maybe don't use a racial slur.
Yeah.
If you could avoid that.
Just avoid doing the racist thing, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, make the world a better place.
It takes a little restraint. I know it's tough, but...
It was a heated gaming moment.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man. Yeah, the amount of people that sort of came out of the woodwork to defend an action like that is really unfortunate. You know,
there's nothing defensible about it. Like, how do you defend it, right?
You know, we had a lot of people playing semantics. You know, I mean, like anything in this, like, very politically charged time, yes, where, you know, if anything sort of resemble, I think, like, issues have this really magnetic quality, right, where anything that's sort of, it's not quite about free speech or anything like that, but if it is in the neighborhood, it's going to magnetize and sort of snap to that issue. And then you see all the comments, Twitter responses, yeah, Facebook posts sort of jump onto that and become now like this thing that was about copyright and games and, like, you know, race, I guess, and a popular figure is now about the First Amendment in the United States, right? Because yeah, that's like the nearest thing on the board. And now it becomes like fuel and ammunition for that conversation, yeah, and that debate, because I don't know, I feel like this past week kind of really revealed and a lot of the outcry to this issue revealed the weird addiction a lot of people have to anger on the internet. I truly think it's an addiction for some people, mm-hmm, to want to be upset, you know, want to use any excuse to divide people and you know, get into issues about why racism is okay and like, no, this, you know, saying this word that it has like a profound meaning in history against Black people, like, no, that's not actually racist, you know, it's really unfortunate. And above that, like, okay, like one of the things we grapple with a lot is like folks, you know, folks who think and somehow object to us covering issues that have any kind of political,
yeah,
aspect to them. Yeah. And it's something that we get, it's not fair to say we get a lot of criticism for, but there's like a section of the audience, you know, a section of that pie graph or whatever that is really upset that whenever, you know, an issue relating to gender or race or, you know, I don't know, like countries and national issues kind of becomes part of our reporting, right? And I feel like it's unrealistic to expect us to, you know, somehow neuter real world issues from gaming. Like if we want gaming to be a part of our lives that's meaningful and important and sort of reflect that in our work and reflect that in what we hold gaming up to be, which I would like to think most of us want it to be more than a toy, more than a distraction, more than a diversion. I think we all value those aspects of games, but I think we want it to be more than that, you know, not simply sort of entertainment that distracts us from, mm-hmm, real world issues. And I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm most frustrated by those folks in a way because it's like asking us to treat something that we love and respect a lot, games, you know, we have like a profound ability to affect people and, you know, have a lot of interesting things to say and treat it like it's a toy.
Yeah. And, there's no way it clashes with this perception that games are taken, aren't taken seriously enough, that, you know, and nerds aren't taken. So, you know, like, it's this narrative that's been going on for decades and decades. And in order to be taken seriously, you need to be a citizen away from the world and hide from the world. And I think PC games and video games and everything are, you know, obviously part of that system, part of that, mm-hmm, world. And to ignore that is to, I don't know, invite conflict and...
Well, it's also just foolish to think, yeah, to think that games... Any game is not political in some way.
Absolutely.
I mean, they don't exist in a vacuum. Like, these things are related to gaming. They, yeah, have to do with gaming culture, and that's why we cover them.
Call of Duty World War II is an intensely political game, for example. It may not
so political
address gender politics. It may not address, you know, the Second Amendment or free speech or anything along that, like these like contemporary issues, but it's a game produced by Americans about, you know, from an American point of view that's reflecting our version of history as entertainment. You know, that's immensely wrapped up in politics. if Call of Duty was produced by a Russian company or a Japanese company, or, you know, a more diverse group of people, or all women, like it would be different, because it reflects the intentions and sort of politics of the people that make it. And I think that's an interesting thing to be talking about, you know. It's certainly not the only thing we talk about, I feel like.
No, I mean,
at all.
I made a dumb article about loot boxes the other day, and it was really silly. And we have, you know, games are fun, and we will celebrate that, and they're interesting and a good time. But yeah. I think we as editors, and we, you know, want more from games, and we want more from people who play them. And I'm excited to, you know, with games being as, you know, omnipresent as they are, and with so many coming out, I'm excited for that. I'm excited to see how it's different and what they have to say and so on.
Well, maybe the right way of tackling this is to open it up to our audience.
There you go.
And our Q&A.
Nice segue. Getting right to it. Before I do that, excuse me. Well, actually, I'll ask for them right now. We're going to move on to our Twitch chat Q&A. So if you have a question for us about video games, PC games, any old question, just tag us in the chat. Tag PC Gamer and ask us your question. We're going to prioritize Twitch subscribers and club members first. We have a couple existing club member questions already from our Discord. If you don't know what the PC Gamer Club is, go to club.pcgamer.com. It's a pretty cool deal. I think our Discord is probably one of the favorite things, the best things that has happened since I've been here. It's just one of my favorite places to hang out. Some really, really cool people in there. But you get a bunch of other stuff. I'll let you check that out at club.pcgamer.com. Get us those questions. I'm going to type the topic in right here.
Oh, Billions of Sloths wants to know if I'm a Red Wings fan. Absolutely. Absolutely. Detroit's not going to be doing very well this year, I'm afraid. But I'm a lifelong Michigan sports fan, but especially the Red Wings.
Right on. I think we'll open up while they roll in. I got some from the Discord earlier. There's some pretty good ones, too. Excuse me. Buttface Jones asks, games improve every single day in every possible regard. Graphics, storytelling, performance, competition, all these things are better than they were last year. And last year was better than the year before, et cetera, et cetera. Given that we are continuously in the midst of the greatest gaming age, or greatest age of gaming, and each year is the best year in the history of the hobby, why is everybody always so fucking mad about video games? Thanks. What do you guys think? What's the phenomenon? It kind of tails off our conversation.
I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with what you said earlier, Evan. Like, people, I don't know if they're addicted to, but people like being angry and getting up in arms about things on the internet. Would you believe that people like to be angry on the internet?
Yeah, I would say, I don't know. This is also. Maybe just the tools and how many games and how much media is out there that everyone can kind of be an authority on them, or at least experience enough of them to feel like an authority on whatever media it is they're talking about. I mean, anytime a TV show comes out, Game of Thrones, you see everyone's take on it, what they would do better. I do this, you know, like I'm the man who thinks he knows what can make this good, even though I've never worked in television. And some people maybe take that too far, kind of latch on, like in this, I'm not a social scientist, latch on to sort of, there's like a, I don't know, a tribal mentality when it comes to feeling like a part of a movement or part of a, like, reassured, even if you're not, you haven't fully researched or thought out your take, to feel part of a wave, kind of have people on your side. That probably feels good.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And I feel like a lot of the public forums for discussion are increasingly systems that are driven by that reward, I guess, you know, who's going to be the most clever, who's going to have the most cynical thing to say, who's going to be the sort of the fastest to react. You know, if you look at Twitter,
oh God,
if you look at Reddit, these are both forums or areas where you're earning points and sort of your message is spreading. And I think increasingly based on that, right? Like, how can you, and that almost like encourages you to exaggerate slightly. It encourages you to be, you know, if not 10%, maybe 50% angrier, more upset. And often like when some, when global events occur, often I think one of the things that tires me out the most is just there's sort of this proliferation to see who can be the most upset, right? So I don't know, what's the latest like Air 37 style fuck up that a developer's done? You know, No Man's Sky is a huge one, right?
Yeah,
we can just think back as far as that and say, like, I really felt like, you know, yeah, as much as there were some major issues in that game, there was this real sort of month long, I would say, if not more, kind of battle to see like who can be the most bothered, you know, who can be the most like angry about a game that just ultimately like wasn't great, you know, underdelivered, yeah, like mm-hmm. misrepresented itself, you know, check all those boxes for sure. That's all true. But like the eagerness to sort of draw it out and sort of, you know, be addicted to that like level of indignance. Cause I don't know. I mean, I feel like people have, you know, I'm not a psychologist or anything. I feel like it taps into like our fight and flight response, you know, and our brains kind of reward anger in a lot of ways. Cause it overrides like morality and logic, right? You don't have to be like moral and sort of rational when you're angry because something's wrong, damn it. And, you know, that takes precedent over anything. And, you know, I demand satisfaction. So I don't know. It's a real issue in gaming. It's a real issue in gaming criticism, not just us, but like, I think everyone who talks about and critiques and comments on games, I'm really done with cynicism. You know, I'm really done with that kind of attitude that, I don't think it came out of YouTube. I think there were actually, frankly, a lot of magazine columnists back in the 90s who were snarky,
inflammatory. Yeah,
who pushed that attitude, and it doesn't even come out of games. You can just look in any kind of medium, film and music. But I do think that YouTube has sort of, you know, made it more prominent and sort of.
It's definitely fostered that culture.
It's created a template, right, where. Okay, I don't mean to call out anyone in particular, but like, you know, Angry Joe is like a very popular YouTuber, and like at the beginning, his whole shtick was about being upset.
Angry. Yeah, yeah.
Like if I don't know, and I know he's a lot more than that, and like he seemed like a really super nice guy. I don't mean to call him out and sort of,
but there is like
point that in particular. Yeah. But it's an interesting example of how if we're talking about anger, we're talking about cynicism. How it's really become commoditized within gaming. It's become a resource like, okay, do you want to hear someone upset about video games? Oh boy, there's a ton of channels for you. There's a ton of those out there if you want that, right? And of course, like, it's entertaining to see people who are passionate, and you want to, and when you hear someone's angry, you want to know kind of what's behind that, because there must be some sort of reason. Someone's done something wrong. There's some injustice, right?
Wait, you mean somebody is wrong on the internet?
Possibly.
Impossible.
So I don't. There's a lot of work here. I think we continue to grapple with it and figure it out. But
yeah,
hopefully, I'd love to see more positivity. If somebody in our comments and on Twitch here has a good answer for how to make gaming a more positive and cool place. And
the one final thing that I'll say is like when you talk about the people who are angry at games for critical reasons, you know, people who call out. Systems and basically are angry about the problems that games have. When I say problems, I mean problems with, you know, gender and racial representation, problems with, you know, all these different things that some people get very angry about. Mm-hmm. And that when you're angry in that type of way, I feel like these are people who want, the only reason for that anger is because they want games to be better. So they care about games. They're not trying to destroy games. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to like tear it all down. They're trying to chisel away at the bad stuff and make it better. Yeah. So
important distinction. Big difference between that and the rush to market to get the first Clifford Blazinski Lawbreakers montage out. That is angry. Oh, the game has a low player count. I don't see that. Anyway.
That's a whole.
Let's not go there. But. Just bullying.
I want to go there for a sec.
Okay.
I really think, okay, Steam Spy has only been around for like a year and a half in a prominent way. PC gaming in particular is becoming a popularity contest. And I think it actually adds this toxicity we're talking about where, okay, I mean, think about the number of games, even sort of like prominent games from either interesting independent developers or AAAs or whatever you want to call them, you know, over the past couple of years that have come out and have probably not done as well as people thought they would, right? Hundreds of them, dozens of them, you know, in a few months span easily. But now that we have this ability to sort of monitor and see how many people are playing something, we can use it against them as this weapon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really unfortunate. You know, I think there is a legitimate case in some cases to say, okay, like as a reviewer, we want to call out when we're experiencing like high queue times and stuff like that.
Not when there are like actually not enough people to play a game, that's an issue.
When it's affecting the experience. But honestly, how many people do you need worldwide even to sustain a competitive multiplayer game like Lawbreakers? That's
a good question.
4-on-4,
right?
Right. You don't need a ton of, you don't need millions of people, hundreds of thousands of people, you know. We've been playing that game over the past month, and it's been totally fine, easy to get into.
Success is not measured by the Steam charts top 100.
So, but it's, of course, it's very fun and entertaining to, you know, bully and beat up on someone like Cliff Bleszinski, who's some, you know, he's like a very controversial figure for some folks, like very outspoken, it's probably better described, and sort of use that against them, right? When, I mean, What about Rainbow Six Siege? Like, should we go back to that launch and see how popular it was? Because that game has grown immensely. It took 2+ years for it to get the audience it did. And that's kind of the reality of a lot of multiplayer games. And that's, I think that's what a lot of this practice of stats bullying, I'm going to call it, forgets and just totally ignores, is like so many multiplayer games are at their peak, not at launch, but several years later, when they've had a lot of time to build up that audience and find their audience.
Yeah, Evolve was one of these early examples where it had problems with its marketing and design, but I can't tell you how many people I met or saw in comments or whoever, that had never played Evolve, didn't really know what it was about, but considered it and called it a piece of shit because of its player count. So, I don't know. Just give these games some time. Like, understand that player count within a week or a month, several months, is not a chart for success necessarily.
No, I mean, we should be doing the opposite, right? I mean, in this time of immense saturation of games, I think everybody should be doing their part to sort of, you know, hold up the games that are actually good, that aren't getting enough attention sort of the player base that they could find.
Cool. Wow. Feel good. Feel good message.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of time left, so we're going to move through some questions quickly, if you guys don't mind doing like sort of a
lightning round.
Favis asks, which game other than The Witcher, because it's already happening, is it, would you like to see turned into an HBO or other channel live action series? I didn't know The Witcher was an HBO thing.
I feel like I heard about that, but Netflix. I also don't remember.
I don't think it's HBO, but yeah.
I think Deus Ex would be pretty cool.
Deus Ex could be pretty good.
Okay, Stargate, but XCOM.
Whoa. I would love to see The Chosen. Who would you cast as the assassin? I wonder.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
That's good. That's good.
God
that's
damn,
good.
That's pretty good. For me, I don't know. I mean, it's another immersive sim, but Dishonored's World seems like one to explore. Maybe not from the perspective of an assassin, but... I want more stories from that world. Maybe that's political drama.
That's a great world. Like,
or give me Downton Abbey, but Dishonored.
Nice.
Excuse me.
Oh, Downton Abbey with a lot more backstabbings and
literal backstabbing.
Mosquitoes that kill people.
Moving on here, Apollo Dingo. What game that release? Apollo's trolling. What game that releases this week are you most excited about? I think he's implying Dishonored, Death of the Outsider,
and Divinity 2. Yeah,
Divinity 2. So two big releases, it's going to get busy. It's starting to get pretty busy.
My understanding is that Divinity, I only saw like as a headline or a press release, it has like a fully voiced now or something in English and probably another language or two, because that game is made in Germany? Larian Studio, are they in Germany? Yeah.
That or Sweden, I don't know.
Right. That's cool. I don't know, it seems like they've really spent a lot, like the proper amount of time in that game, and it's going to be a great successor.
Cool series. JBJ Blaze, in light of South Park returning tonight with its 21st season, what feature or element do you look most forward to in the Fractured But Whole? For me, it would have to be the Nauseous Rift. But that turned out to be only a promo toy. I think that was like the fart attachment for the face. Class today. Anyway, so what, you guys looking forward to this game at all? South Park?
I'm not a South Park fan at all.
I'm not either.
But
I played the first one, and I'm not a huge South Park fan either. Excuse me. But so I can't really like, I think it has like a grid-based combat system this time, so.
I do think it was good commentary that if you're playing a black character, the game is more difficult for you. That linking back to our discussion about, of games being political, right?
That was pretty interesting. I hear, though, that it actually has no bearing on the actual difficulty.
Oh, what?
Which is kind of an empty joke, right?
Oh, really?
So it would have been cool if that actually, I don't know, that would have been a sort of a bold thing, you know, for to include, but don't take my word for it. I'll take my word for it. Excuse me.
Well, in that case, I retract my praise. That feels kind of cheap.
Yeah, yeah. Question for Bo.
Thing to do.
Yeah. Interfuser asks, this is for you, Bo. Bo Overwatch.
Oh, that's me.
Deathmatch / Team Deathmatch have been out for a few weeks now. What's your opinion on those?
To be perfectly honest, this is weird. I actually haven't played much Deathmatch yet. I've been playing XCOM. I've been waiting for the, so the Deathmatch patch hit live, but there's like a big bulk of character changes and balance changes that's on PTR right now. There's like the Mercy changes, there's the Junkrat rework, all this stuff, and I'm basically just waiting for that to go live, and then I'm planning on diving back into Overwatch and playing. We'll probably play some Deathmatch at that point. Cool. But yeah, I don't have a lot to say about it.
I'm curious to try because I just love a good Deathmatch. Be interesting to see all those mismatched characters going up against one another.
Yes or no, with no follow-up, Bo, is bloat going to become a problem for Overwatch? Feature bloat?
I don't think so, because they usually, these kind of one-off modes, they're stuck over in the arcade and not integrated too much.
I guess they are kind of buried.
Yeah, like you can go play Capture the Flag if you want, you can go play Deathmatch if you want, but you're not forced into it in the queue. I think if they were cycled into the competitive queue or even the quick play queue, then that would be an issue, because they're different, like drastically different game types. And the skill sets are very different. I don't think that would be good, but yeah, having them sequestered over in their own place, I think it's fine.
Okay. Excuse me. A couple more real quick. Workster with the PC Gamer Club. I've noticed beta access for games has been given out. And I was wondering if you were still giving out full game keys. So, to clarify, the beta keys we give out are usually on top of, they're the icing on the cherries, on the icing on the cake.
On the gravy. it's a really disgusting cake.
But it's an awful cake. It's a pretty good cake.
It's good.
Try
it's good
before
cake.
You knock it. So we just sent out, and if you still join for this foreseeable future, probably through the month, we'll see how many keys we have. You can get beta access to The Amazing Eternals. That's Digital Extremes' bizarre, like, first-person shooter deck-building game. Will eventually be free-to-play, but that's, like, 3 to 6 months out or so. So if you join, get that key. But you also get a monthly game key on top of that. The game key, the monthly game key, full game key, guaranteed. Beta keys, as we get them, we're going to give them to you.
So, yeah.
You know, it's kind of a fun, I feel good when I set those emails up. I'm just like, surprise. I feel like a beta key Santa Claus. let's play some Amazing Eternals together. Real quick, Chocolate Goomba. Will James and his dad be added as DLC characters to Far Cry 5?
Funny you mentioned that.
Would you be willing to support a change.org position to make it so? I really wish that were to happen, but who knows? I wrote an article a couple months back, kind of jokingly asking for it, but now whenever I go play the game at an event, I get called the dad guy by everyone there. So they know who I am, and it's kind of funny to see that recognized. They always give me a bunch of crap. And I'm getting kind of coffee, so it might be it. Evan, there was a question for you about Wargroove.
Oh, cool.
I kind of missed it above. What did you think of it? You played it at PAX, didn't you?
So they were only showing that in the Nintendo Switch, but I talked to them briefly at PAX. I did a short video interview with them. One of the things that I asked them about was matchmaking. They didn't really give me a satisfactory answer. I think that's a big question for me, right? Because Chucklefish. I mean, they've done Starbound. Mm-hmm. That's and Terraria. That's, you know, those are multiplayer games, obviously, but competitive matchmaking, it's not really something that they're used to. So that's like one kind of unanswered question I'm curious about. I don't know. I mean, otherwise the game continues to look great. I think I'm really purely curious about kind of what is the most interesting, absurd campaign that I'm going to be able to create in that game, because not only does it have a map editor, it has a campaign editor that sits above that, so I can create triggers within maps and missions that affects this overall single player campaign.
Cool. Yeah. I'm excited for it.
Yeah,
I'm excited about the trend of Nintendo games pretty much coming to PC, not officially, but
if Nintendo's not going to do it,
we will.
Indie developers will. So
yeah, that's all the time we have for this week. You can always catch us 1 p.m. Pacific time every Wednesday for the PC Gamer Show. If you're on iTunes or whatever your podcast subscription service is, leave us a review. We want that feedback. And if you're on YouTube, youtube.com/PCGamer, you can catch the show there. Stop by and ask us a question. We like, excuse me, people in chat. I'm really losing my voice here. So with that...
Yeah. poor James. I should have just done the outro. I'm sorry, buddy.
All good.
Yeah, guys, thanks for bearing with us. James, please recover from your acute bronchitis.
So close. So close. I just can't talk for more than 1.5 hours at a time.
We're glad you're here to help.
You're right at your limit.
That's right. Well, thanks for joining us, guys. Definitely find us on Discord. Find us in our comments, and we'll look forward to seeing you there. Thanks for watching.
Jesus says you have stolen my heart. My bride, you have stolen my heart with just one look of your eyes. How delightful is your love, my bride? How much more pleasing is your love than wine? Our lips drop sweetness like the honeycomb, Jesus. Milk and honey flow from our mouths. May the fragrance of our praises reach you. Let the fragrance of our worship please you. Thank you.